This episode of Putting It Together is brought to you by Chick Murray, a funny place for a window.
Now, we're talking about this and that, and these are things of which I know very little. In fact, I went to the doctor's the other day, and I sat down, and the fellow sat next to me, and he said, "What do you make of this?" I said, "Well, I don't think much of that." I was fascinated with this long-nosed woman. Somebody nodded to her. She nodded back and cut the cake. The bride was in tears. So was the cake.
Playing at venues across the Central Belt this August. Come along. Give yourself a break. Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of Putting It Together. How are you? I am doing well, and I'm really delighted to be bringing you this episode with my guest, Michael John McCarthy. This is someone who I've been having requested as a guest for some time. Lots of people say, "You've got to get MJ on, you've got to get MJ on." And we have, and actually, MJ agreed to be on the podcast ages ago, and again, you know the way it is. Diaries, schedules, whatever. So finally we're here, and I'm so glad we are. And do you know what? There's a million other things we could have talked about, more things. But what we did get into was joy. MJ's young life and his love of music and his foray into theatre at university. And just, yeah, it's just so interesting. And he's such a lovely, lovely man and a very talented and an interesting soul, you know, a nice person to have around, nice energy to have around. So I was delighted to spend that time with him, get to know him a wee bit better, be able to bring you the opportunity for you to get to know him a wee bit better as well. So thank you ever so much for tuning in. And thanks for your ongoing support as well. I get these great... the one that happened to me the other day, I was going to say I get great messages, but the ones I love are the funny little tweets that mention the show and people say what they're up to when they're listening to the show. And the good one that happened the other day was Adam McNamara. I saw a tweet came up and he said, "Oh, I'm travelling Glasgow to London and back, or London to Glasgow and back in one day. But I feel like my friends are with me because I've got PitCC Pod," which, by the way, is the handle for Twitter and Instagram, PitCC Pod. So, I looked at that and I remembered that on that same day, I had actually seen him in Glasgow Central Station, and I wasn't 100% sure it was him, and I was rushing by, and also I've never actually met him, although I know his work and so on. So I was toying with the idea of going up and saying, "Are you Adam McNamara? Will you be on my podcast?" Which I do all the time now, and people must be, "Oh, here he comes." But then I saw this tweet, and he had... You know, not only had he been in Central Station at the same time as me, but he had been potentially listening to this show. So I tweeted him back and I said, "Well, will you be on the show? What a weird thing." And he said, "Of course, put me on the list." So at some point, that's someone... I normally don't give away the guests, but it's not something that I've got in the can yet. It's just another person on the very long list of great people who've agreed to do the show and who we now have to find time slots for. With everyone's busy schedules permitting and so on. I would love if I had some wonderful person who would edit the show, you know, engineer everything, book all the guests, do the transport. Love that. Would love that. But we're not there yet. So in the meantime, I've got this massive list and it's just in a wee note in my phone and I try and keep up with it. I'm doing the very best I can. So, yeah. That's where we're at. That's what's happening. The list is growing with all the wonderful people that have said yes. And today, the person who said yes was Michael John McCarthy. And what a pleasure. Now, if you want to support the show, there's a great way you can do it financially. And it doesn't cost much at all, but it really is appreciated. This is based on the show being free for everybody. And if you are feeling flush or you think that this is a project that's worth your time and worth a wee contribution, then you can show that thanks by going right to the website, which is puttingittogethercast.com, and attached to each episode, of the last 2 weeks or 3 weeks or so, there's a donate button. That's a long way around of saying on the front page, you'll find a yellow donate button, and that is for PayPal. You can just hit that button and you can either donate something one-off, you can donate a set amount every month, you can choose your amount or you can choose one of the preset amounts. It's very simple, and for information, it does cost you less than Patreon did. So, if you're a Patreon person and you want to dump that in favour of PayPal, please feel free. And if you're a new person, Don't be worried about Patreon. I think we're all going to do better from PayPal, at least for now. So, if you want to show some support, PayPal is the way to do it, and there's a yellow donate button on the website, which once again is puttingittogethercast.com. And of course you can make noise about me on social media, not just me, but the show, and that's PittCCPod on Twitter and Instagram, and on Facebook, just by searching Putting It Together, you can find the wee page. So that's all the plugs for this week, except to say, and this is probably the most important one of all for now, this week at A Play, A Pie and A Pint, if you pop down, you can see Dusty Won't Play by Annie Caulfield. It's directed by Marilyn Imrie, and as many of you will know, it stars Andy Clark, Kevin Lennon and Frances Thorburn. That's in alphabetical order. Frances and Marilyn have both been on the show. And Kevin and Andy, as far as I know, have agreed to be on the show at some point. So it's not too late to see that. There's still a few days. It runs till Saturday, the 22nd of June. It's Dusty Won't Play, about Dusty Springfield. And it's by Annie Caulfield. And Frances Thorburn plays Dusty Springfield. What a treat. So do get down if you can. So now it's time for my guest of the week. It's Michael John McCarthy. And he's with me. And we are Putting It Together.
Are we on?
Sure, if you want.
Okay.
I mean, it isn't, you know, I don't have any specific way of starting.
Sure, I know. I gathered. Yeah,
I'm not good with beginnings.
In medias res, is this what seems to be the way of it.
Even in writing or performing or anything, yeah. I just kind of, well. Right, so,
yeah,
I don't know. I say so quite a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Even so in conversation. Is one of my favourite words.
I saw someone complaining the other day online. Youngsters, when they answer a question beginning with so.
Well,
that's perfect, though.
What I would say to them is Seamus Heaney's translation of Beowulf, which is widely recognized as a bit of a literary masterwork.
Mm.
The first word is so.
There you go.
And it's just beautiful. I just, yeah.
Yeah,
because
I think
he's trying to catch the conversationality of the telling of that story. And so if you start to tell the story, naturally, so.
It's a setting up.
Yeah, exactly.
And a grounding, kind of a leveling. All right, are we all...
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, are you sitting comfortably?
Yeah.
And I'll begin.
Absolutely.
Maybe I should say that at the beginning. it's already gone, though.
Tried and tested.
Yeah. I made up catchphrases without realising them.
Did
the first ever episode I did, I said, the first words came out of my mouth, hello, hello. I said hello twice. And now I'm stuck with it. I do it every episode. And at the end I said, cheerio now, which is a very Irish thing to say.
Yeah.
Cheerio now.
Cheerio now.
My dad says that. Very good now.
Tell me, you've probably told me this before, where is your dad from?
He was born in Glasgow, but his parents and they're going up and up, they were from Donegal.
Donegal. From the town.
From the town, yeah, yeah. So there are still numerous Seamus and Brian O'Sullivans in Donegal town.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To the point where one of the Brian O'Sullivans died not so long ago,
uh-huh.
And I got the wrong end of the stick and commiserated because of thinking in my head, not that I would commiserate any less.
Of course.
But I was like, and I started saying, so will you be going over for the funeral and stuff? And I said, what do you mean going over to the south side? And it was a different Brian O'Sullivan who lived in Glasgow.
Yeah,
there's so many of us. And actually, they used to be known by not the last name because it was all the same,
yeah,
but by the name of the street that they grew up, the family home was in.
Oh, wow.
So my dad was Seamus Randolph because they lived in Randolph Road.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm from the Randolph O'Sullivans, if you like.
The Randolph O'Sullivans.
There's so many.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Presumably there's a few McCarthys where you come from.
So yeah, there are three branches of McCarthys, or historically there were three branches, kind of, three strands to the clan. Of McCarthy, and there's McCarthy Moore, who I think were, I mean, I'm essentially making this up, but my understanding was that they were kind of chieftains of the sort of Munster area, or certainly the Cork area for a period of time.
Mm.
And Kerry, I think it's kind of Cork and Kerry, which are the two counties next to each other in the southwest of Ireland, where I'm from. But I don't know if we're McCarthy Moores or the other branch. I haven't gone that far back in terms of the genealogy.
It'd be a fair bit back before you were captains and of clans and so on.
But the other big family names around there, O'Mahony is a big one.
Oh, I know an O'Mahony actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they had these, my understanding is kind of Norman era watchtowers or castles dotted all along the coast. And weirdly, one of these, the White Castle, is on the farm where my mum was born and where her brothers and sisters still live. So in the family, like, we have a castle. We have this O'Mahony Castle on the land.
And it's not the White Castle of the burger the low-budget burger chain in America. It's not. So they went to America and made a new life.
You wouldn't rule it out. Maybe the O'Mahony's.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Took it with them.
So if you go to the original White Castle in Wisconsin or something, yeah, say, yeah. Oh, my grandpappy was Irish and we started over here.
My name's
Mahony.
Yeah. Mahoney,
yeah, of course.
Yeah. Well, one of the other O'Mahony castles was bought and refurbished by Jeremy Irons. So he has one of these castles further along the coast. Kilco Castle is Jeremy's.
And he lives there?
Well, he spends time there, certainly. Yeah.
Didn't Michael Flatley buy some ridiculous...
Yeah, he's got something in West Cork. I mean, there's the world of them.
Yeah.
David Putnam, the producer and filmmaker, is there. I feel like there was some talk of... Maybe Kevin Costner came on a holiday once or something.
There was talk once.
There was talk.
No, one of his films was shown at the cinema once. I remember now.
No, there's this brilliant pub in Ballardy Hub, which is the closest town, called Leavis's. There have been podcasts about Leavis's. It is
really?
In and of itself, it's a tremendous place. And it was run by these two brilliant women, Nell and Julia. And leave us these two sisters, and their great nephew Joe has since taken it over, and it's become a bit of a hub in the town, actually. But one of the stories is that Kevin Costner called in to Leavis's at one point, with a kind of cap and shades or whatever, and then the words went around Ballardy Hub. This would have been around peak Costner,
right? Okay,
so Dance with Wolves or Waterworld or whatever,
mm-hmm.
And the word went around, and eventually someone told him, I think it was Nell. And apparently Nell at one point just came up behind him and put her hand on his shoulder and said, I know who you are, but I won't tell anyone.
That's a good, she's a good woman.
Just to reassure him.
Very good. Yeah. And did other people know? Was it moot, do you think?
I assume the whole town knew, but
she was letting on.
I won't tell anyone.
I don't think anyone knows. One's noticed.
Your secret's safe with me.
Love it.
They were tremendous women. I mean, they both lived to old ages.
Mm-hmm.
Like late 90s, possibly over 100.
Still running the place, do you think?
Well, no. Well, they were. Yeah, they were. Their niece, so Joe's mum would have come in and helped them run the bar, and then Joe himself, like I say, eventually took over.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the stories I remember, my aunt Eileen sort of asked one of them at one point, what's the secret? You're 99 or whatever, what's the secret? And apparently she answered, enjoy the day. And I was like, that's actually...
Right, that was it?
Yeah.
It's, what else is there?
There's kind of everything in it, isn't there?
There is.
It's really beautiful.
Because we've overcomplicated it to some crazy degree, mm-hmm. haven't we?
You just enjoy the day.
Is that what you do?
I think it's what I try to do.
Is it really?
I honestly do. I honestly do try to remind myself at various points during the day, you have it so good, you are so lucky, things are so good, so many things are so good and so fortunate. In terms of what I get to do and where I get to be and all that sort of stuff. I think it's healthy.
Definitely is. Well, basically gratitude, isn't it?
Yeah.
They say that that's the key.
Uh-huh.
And then we've come up with, a billion-dollar industry of books that remind us of it.
Yeah, exactly.
in varying ways.
And, this 99-year-old pub landlady from Ballardy Hub kind of got it in three words.
It's there. Enjoy the day.
Enjoy the day.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you were from out of town, like mm-hmm. a farm which wasn't even in the town.
I'm from a townland called Capanacolly.
Right.
Which no one can kind of agree quite how to spell it. We spell it one way, it's spelled differently on the map. I mean, I think the loose translation is sort of plot or, I guess, sort of field or plot of the witch or hag.
Mm-hmm.
Hag's plot, witch's plot. And it's a couple of fields essentially. Well, it's a few fields, and the sort of the townland system where I'm from anyway, and it's kind of all over the country, but particularly in the southwest, is every sort of four or five fields is kind of divided up into a townland,
mm-hmm.
and it's just a way of kind of knowing where people live. So there'll only be a handful of other families living in Capanacolly.
Is that within a parish then or something?
And that's all within the parish of Ballardy Hub.
Right.
But that's kind of... So Ballardy Hub is the sort of smaller village, which I've just been speaking about with Leavis's pub, and that's where I went to primary school. And then kind of the bigger village on the other side of us is Skull. That's kind of the sort of seaside town, and that's where I went to secondary school. So we were kind of sort of perfectly in the middle between Skull and Ballardy Hub.
And Skull is where the West Cork audio series...
Exactly.
Was set or what happened.
Yeah, and the events in the West Cork audio series, which I haven't listened to, but I'm obviously very aware of, took place on the other side of Skull.
Right. Wow.
In the late 90s.
The question is, when you do interviews and when you speak to people, is Irishness and Ireland often the beginning of this conversation?
Maybe.
And if it is, I'm sorry.
No. I think I sometimes think I probably put it there, very happily put it there. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, it's something I've sort of done a little bit of work on. I did this piece called Turntable, which was a participatory arts project, which initially began with me taking boxes of records to public places and encouraging people to have conversations. Mm-hmm. And it kind of sort of grew legs over time. And eventually there was a sort of a performance version a couple of years ago where I effectively sort of stood up and told the story of the project. And one of the things, well, the genesis of Turntable was after I moved here, I became very close with my great aunt Kitty, so my mum's mum's sister, who lived in London. And in many ways, I felt that she was kind of the trailblazer for me. She left West Cork when she was 18 in the late 40s.
That's
so she,
big.
Yeah, yeah. So 1948, she moved to London.
Wow.
And
right after the war as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the emergency, as we called it. All right. Yeah, seriously.
Wow.
Because Ireland maintained neutrality. So technically that period of time is known as the emergency. Seriously.
But then she went to a place that wasn't involved in the emergency, was involved in the war.
Absolutely.
My goodness.
She went to London, which is just an extraordinary thing to think about.
Mm.
And so many did. But yeah, Kitty set out to do that and took these sort of secretarial courses and eventually got work, I think, for the British Coal Board in Uganda, or whatever Uganda would have been known as at the time, still under British rule. And so she got a boat to Uganda in the 50s, spent about a year and a half living and working out there.
Wow.
Came back to London and then spent the rest of her life working in that big Shell building, for Shell in that big building in the centre of London.
And did she ever marry?
No.
So the tune Kitty's Wedding is not after her then?
No, it's not.
Do you know it?
I don't think
it's a hornpipe.
I don't know that I know it, but if you...
You do. It goes...
I do. Yeah.
So it's not to do with her.
It's not to do with her.
And there's Kitty going a-milking as well. But listen, we won't get into all that.
If Kitty could hear me now, she'd be... Probably the first thing she'd say would stop calling me Kitty. Because we all called her Kitty within the family, but I think she preferred Kathleen.
I'm sure in London she was Kathleen.
Well, no, what was fascinating was when I eventually did meet her friends in the late noughts, and she, unfortunately, she became very unwell and she passed away, maybe four or five years after I moved over. Mm. So I met a number of her friends in the context of that, and they all called her Kate.
Kate, right.
And what kind of fascinated me was when I, met her as a, 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-old in the 1980s, she seemed really exotic and English. Because she really made an effort to take on almost like a received pronunciation accent.
Right.
Or it, at least to my ears, she was like sort of exotic. And
well,
kind
it's
of,
all relative, isn't it?
And kind of posh, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And she would do these, she would show us photographs of her holidays in Egypt and Italy and all these kind of incredible places. So she was extraordinary. She was extraordinary, but she seemed especially extraordinary to me. And then what I discovered in those later years, and she would have been in her late 70s, is that amongst her peer group and her friends, She was always Irish Kate. Mm. So as much as I thought of her as English Kitty,
she
was at the very same time Irish Kate. And the sort of...
It's funny how that happens, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because, I suppose here, you're the Irish, you're Michael John McCarthy, and you're very much an Irish guy.
Yeah,
and totally. Probably your friends back home say, oh, he's away to the...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the big city or whatever. Well, it's not so much now as it would have been in the 40s and 50s.
No, but even still, people would take the piss... When I kind of came home, particularly in the first year or two after moving, if they got the slightest hint of anything approaching, well, actually just Scottish vocab, when I would say, if I said a wee something, they're like, Do you know?
Oh, yeah, you don't get away with much when
you've gone
back
full
home.
Scottish now, full Scottish.
Well, he'd be wanting potato scones with his breakfast, I suppose.
Tatty scones, aye. Tatty.
So yeah. What brought you, what was the first thing that made you move?
The thing that made me move was technically a master's in screen studies.
So you had already studied back home?
I studied English and philosophy. Was my degree.
And did you, to go back a bit, mm-hmm. when you decided on that degree, mm-hmm. did you have a sense of what you wanted to do with it? Or was it sort of a routine going into university type thing?
So I was the first person in my extended family to go to university. We're kind of all farmer people, small farmer people. And it was, without getting too social history about it, secondary school in Ireland only became sort of free for all in the late 1960s, and that was a massive kind of, as a revolutionary thing.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So there was a private element to it.
Well, you had to, if you wanted to avail a secondary education, you had to pay for it up until the late 1960s, and then then it became free. So my dad had to left education when he was 11. He left primary school when he was 11. That was the end of his formal education.
Amazing.
And that would have been the early 60s, early 1960s. So so he talks about it all the time as being this massive turning point for the country when, you know, any farmer's son could go get a secondary education. And for my parents, particularly in that sort of 80s moment, like, education was the passport to something other than working the farm. And my dad's refrain over and over again was, don't be a slave like your father, don't be a slave like your father. Wow. So it was kind of really sort of drilled into us that education was the way out and the way off the farm. And I suppose the thing that kind of occurred during my adolescence was that I just fell very much in love with music. Mm-hmm. And there was no formal way to access musical education in the school. It was a very new school. It was a brilliant school in so many ways. But at the time, there wasn't really the option to study music in any formal way, certainly not for what we would have called the Leaving Cert. Mm-hmm. I guess the hires over here.
Right, right. So you could get involved in bits and bobs of music, but there wasn't any, as you say, formalized.
Formal, no.
Okay.
I mean, that was available in bigger schools and you know, and what have you, but it just wasn't offered. It wasn't on the curriculum in our school.
What happened? Did you just listen to music all the time and become engrossed in it?
Yeah, I mean, the track, I suppose. So I got some lessons on the piano accordion, which obviously we share, trad mm-hmm. Irish music on the piano accordion, when I was maybe about 9, 10, 11. Mm-hmm. My brother and I were sent for piano accordion lessons. And it was all part of that thing. It was because my parents didn't play or sing. There was no music for them. But again, it was part of that sort of improving your children via education and accessing all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I guess stuff that they didn't have access to. So, we were sent for trad lessons on the piano accordion. And that was good, but I mean, I was listening to, you know, like Blur and stuff.
Yeah, okay. And so it doesn't marry up very much.
Exactly. Yeah. And REM sort of did. I mean, and anyone who knows me at all knows that REM were like kind of massively significant. So I started listening to these REM albums, and I just loved the music so much. And one of the reasons why I loved REM was because you could hear accordions.
Right.
There are several songs that can point them out for you. There's a song called I Believe. There's a song called You Are the Everything. And there's accordions in a rock song. Like, it was like life on other planets. But ultimately, it became apparent that the thing I would need to do is like learn to play the guitar. So I saved up. And at some point, although I can't remember it, I must have said no to the accordion, which I think maybe my parents probably would have been a bit upset about. But I got this nylon string guitar.
Always new stuff. Right? How did you get a guitar, though? I've got this image of like you.
Bandon. We went to Bandon, which is about an hour's drive away. Yeah. Jeffries of Bandon was where I got my nylon string guitar.
And did you play the Humours of Bandon all the way there? This is what's going to happen in this conversation.
I love it. It's been
in my head. Believe it or not, that tune has been in my head today before I saw it.
Seriously?
I was humming it when I was making tea.
Well, I knew. Yeah.
You know it.
I do it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's the Humours of Bandon.
There you go.
So I think I'm going to start an offshoot podcast for trad music minutia.
That's a great idea.
With Brian. Yeah, great title as well. Solid.
It kind of trips off the tongue, doesn't it?
Very speakable.
Yeah.
So you went, you had to travel an hour to get the guitar.
We got the guitar.
You had saved up your pocket money.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then did you just
potato
you
money? I mean, I am such the cliche, but my dad, one of the things my dad did was grow potatoes. So I would spend summers picking potatoes. Yes.
I'm that guy.
So you kept your eyes peeled for any any way you could make some money.
And so I got this nylon string guitar and loved it instantly and would just strum the open strings thinking it must sound amazing.
Oh yeah, that's it. That's what it is to be a kid with an instrument, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. Look, I've got amazing. Yeah. I can strum it. Whoa. So there was a brilliant, the school chaplain. It wasn't a religious school, but there was a school chaplain, a woman called Sister Patricia O'Donovan. And she did these little after-school guitar lessons on a Wednesday, kind of an open drop-in thing. You would just drop in. So I did for about 6 weeks. And she taught us Leaving on a Jet Plane and The Boxer and Let It Be. And then
there's none teaching you
a
Beatles song.
Goodness. She's amazing. She's amazing. Totally amazing.
Amazing.
And then I would, then I learned to play Find the River by R.E.M. from the album Automatic for the People. And it's got a kind of unusual D chord. Strange thing happens with the D. And I played it for Sister Patricia and she's like, oh, you've gone beyond the limits of my knowledge. You know, go forth.
Right, so you've surpassed what she can. Yeah. I can't help you anymore.
Yeah, but you're on your own now.
She wasn't upset. She was happy.
No, she's very happy. And oh. I mean, yeah. And so there I was off into the world. And that was the end of my formal musical education. So everything since then has effectively been sort of picked up through just doing things and
really
osmosis or self-taught or whatever.
So what about reading? Do you read music at all?
It's like treble clef, you know, just about. Single-handed. Right. What I was taught piano accordion through the treble clef, so you know. Same. Yeah, so that's what I can read. But in terms of if you put like, you know, piano music or something in front of me, I've learned to do is translate what I compose into readable forms for musicians who need it.
Oh, that's good.
Through the help of, you know, very kind friends who will cast an eye over things for me, because basically I'll make the music on software, put it into Sibelius. Mm-hmm. So take it from MIDI, turn it into Sibelius, try to make it look sort of, and I know more than I used to, and I definitely feel like it would be good to formalize it at some point, but try to make it look sort of halfway make sense in terms of rhythm and time and all the rest of it, and then usually pass it in front of at least one pal of mine who will be able to go,
is this a gobbledygook?
And they kind of helped me make it work. So it's sure. Something I had to do last year for a piece I did over at the Lyceum, the hour we knew nothing of each other, where just in terms of the time allotted for recording, it just needed to be mm-hmm. players who could read and just music that we could just kind of go through bar by bar.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a learning curve in some ways, but also it was massively satisfying to be able to engage with that language.
Yeah, because I think what happens is we realize that, oh, there's a reason that everyone's using this. It's really useful, yeah, and really effective.
Exactly.
Yeah, and when you learn, like, when you learn that there's one word for the rambling that you do over two sentences to explain a concept.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, so it's that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just as a tool for communication, obviously, it's kind of brilliant. And so it's sort of, but I feel like I've found my way to it through quite a sort of circuitous route.
I feel the same, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
But how does this, I have to know now, how does this strange D chord playing nylon string guitar wizard end up studying English and philosophy?
Ah, so, well, it goes back to that thing where first person in the family to go to university, there is an expectation, a hope, an aspiration that you might do something more like a conventional profession. Mm-hmm. So medicine or accountancy or, you know, teaching. And so, although in my soul, I already probably have started to realize that the thing that's driving me that I'm passionate about is music and the playing of music and the writing of songs. And at this point, it doesn't, how one might go about turning that into a living is not at all obvious. No. And having not studied it formally, I can't even apply to do music at university because I don't have the qualifications that. So art seems like the classic move in that. I mean, I also by this point, I love literature, I love books. Mm-hmm.
that's kind of been there all along as well. I'm very good at it. I have a talent for it. I'm kind of have an aptitude for exams or whatever. So, you know, academically, I've always been kind of fortunate that way. So, doing an arts degree sort of seemed like, it wasn't that it was a holding position necessarily, but it certainly felt like there were options at the other side of it. And what I initially set out to study was English and mathematics, because I also had a bit of a head for numbers. But what I discovered once I got to university, that having a head for numbers and doing mathematics are two very different things.
Is that so?
That's the difference between arithmetic and mathematics. I was very good at arithmetic.
Right.
But once you get into that kind of, you know, the concept, you know, the conceptual nature of maths, whoosh, just flies off into the...
And that's where I got held up, I think. I was grand through standard grade maths.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I could pick up a little, you know, little formula and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But once I got to higher, I couldn't believe the difference. Yeah. I felt like I was just adrift in some bizarre land. Not a clue.
Yeah, this is it. So that's what happened to me when I got to university. But you take, you know, in the first year of the arts degree in Cork, at least, you had to take four subjects anyway. So I also took Italian and philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And Italian was kind of something I knew I probably wouldn't do for very long. Although I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I have a tiny regret, it's that I didn't actually pursue that as something in my degree. If I could do it over, I may well do philosophy and Italian and dingy the English. Right. Although the English in some ways has become probably more helpful in terms of what I do day to day, because there was a degree of studying theatre and within that, or plays at the very least. For the pure pleasure of it, I think sort of I really loved Italian and sort of, and that if I have a, yeah, that's, I think that sort of, having had a facility for languages and having never taken like a European language to fluency is a bit of a, like, you know, missed opportunity.
Hey, but it's not gone yet.
No, there's time. Anyway, so this all feels very circuitous and mad. But anyway, you get to university, discover that maths is mad altogether, but you can do the English and philosophy is very interesting. So when I go to make my choices for what I'm going to take forward as a joint major, it's English and philosophy. Now, all this time, pretty much from my second week in Cork City, I'm living in this student house with these, you know, four other strangers that I don't know. I start going to open mic nights, and I wrote maybe like 100, 120 dreadful songs in my bedroom.
Were they very self-indulgent?
Oh my God.
Tell me, give me some examples. No, please. It's like reading out your diary, isn't it?
It's too painful, Brian. Too painful.
It'll be cathartic, please. Come on.
I remember one of them was called I Can't Make It to Sunday Morning.
Ooh.
It was one of the good ones. That was one of the ones I felt I could play for people.
So it was like, what, the week?
But it was quite jaunty. It was, you know, one of the many, many unrequited love songs. Mm. Not without mentioning her name, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's right on the button, right on the nose.
Yeah.
So what were you reading?
Because
you were talking about you were into literature and books and stuff.
Novels. Mm-hmm. I suppose in that moment in time, I remember reading like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, so 100 Years of Solitude and Love in the Time of Cholera and all that stuff. Do you remember your man Louis de Bernier? I guess he's still, you know, so the Captain Corelli's mandolin guy. He had that kind of trilogy of novels that were also sort of set in sort of fictional sort of South America. So all that was all kind of a piece.
Captain Corelli's mandolin is back as a stage show.
Rona has adapted it. Yeah. Oh, Rona Monroe.
Rona Monroe's adapted it, yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. I've read very good things about it, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, see, at that age,
yes,
in my equivalent, I was reading like The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now,
I read those too. They're great.
Yeah. But I mean, there was no way I was reading Love in the Time of Cholera.
Yeah.
You know?
I was a bit of a weird kid for the books. I mean, my one of my fondest recollections. So when we were in primary school, one of our primary school teachers read us The Hobbit when I was about maybe 9, we'll say. And I remember thinking it was amazing. And someone said, you should read The Lord of the Rings. So I was at the time in the library in Skull, and the library in Skull still is, as far as I know, in this old bank building. So this quite ornate old bank building at the top of the town. So I went in to ask the librarian if she had The Lord of the Rings. And I think, as I recall, I maybe had to get like a special dispensation to join the adult library because it wasn't in the kids section. It was in the adult section. I was under 12 or whatever. Mm-hmm. But furthermore, it had been taken off the shelves because the books were so old and kind of disused.
Oh.
And the books that had been taken off the shelves that but were still stored in the library were literally kept in a vault. So she had to open this enormous vault. And it kind of creaked open, and then she went in digging in these books and came away with these crumbling, falling to pieces, but still readable copies of The Fellowship of the Ring and The Two Towers and The Return of the King.
I bet you thought you had died and gone to heaven. She went to the vault to get the books.
Yeah. So I was 19, 11-ish, I guess, when I read those books. And I mean, yeah, that's what, you know, I was, yeah, totally also a kind of a bit of a fantasy sci-fi nerd kid.
Are you still...
I fell away from it, but I still retain, you know, I'll still watch Star Trek and things like the new Star Trek on Netflix or whatever. There were various kind of kid type passions, like sort of sci-fi and sports and football and all that stuff. But music ultimately just consumed everything. Mm-hmm. By the time I get to sort of 15, 16, there is time for nothing else but listening and playing and listening and playing and listening. It's all I want to do. And it kind of still is.
Yeah, but that's the way of it. Well, yeah, that's good. That's good news.
Yeah, I'm
completely obsessed. Yeah. And I'm obsessed with theatre.
Yeah.
Totally. With actors, with actors' stories, with writers, you know. And that accordion gets picked up every day.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here and I just... And every day I put it down and I go, that's not good enough. And then the next day I pick it up again and I go, maybe I'll be better today. And I keep bloody trying, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's
about
the nature of it.
I haven't yet.
Every now and again, I just want to fling it across the room and say, never again. Yeah. And it just doesn't last. Our little spats that we have, they don't last.
Does your accordion have a name?
No. Mm. I mean, that fucking thing that comes to mind. Because we don't have, you know, the most harmonious relationship. But I keep going back.
Yeah.
It's like an addiction.
Yeah.
Crawling back for more.
This is it.
But yeah, I can't stop. And it's not even, like somebody said to me the other day, it's not like I chose to do this. It's kind of it chose me.
Mm-hmm.
That like I just kind of have to keep doing it. Because what else am I going to do?
Yeah, totally.
Really?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I don't know now. Like, no. You're so far and there's a point beyond which.
Yeah.
It was like, there's a documentary about that band, Silver Mount Zion. So the same people who are in the band Godspeed You Black Emperor.
Oh yeah.
And your man has a quote, which is something along the lines of, if you try to get a regular job now, after having been in a band for 15 years, like his resume, it's kind of the same, or his CV, the same net effect as if he'd been in prison for 15 years.
Yeah.
Like, do you know,
his
kind of qualifications are about the same, or a job experience in terms of sort of regular work.
Where would you even start? I don't think. I don't know how it was. Well, honestly, it's probably better not to think about it because I hope I don't have to.
Yeah, exactly.
At any point. But I'm happy to plough on right now.
Me too.
So you came to over here to do a master's?
Well, so basically, the music thing was going the whole time. And I guess the other strand that becomes involved is the theatre strand, of course.
Mm-hmm,
so I get involved with the kind of student drama society as a first year. And then... this kind of quirk of events happens whereby someone who the technical officer decides she wants to leave, so I become the technical officer of the Student Drama Society after having been in university for about 4 months, and all of a sudden I'm having to light shows. And there's this really, you know, at the time there was this incredible resource, it's still there, the Granary Theatre in University College Cork, which has an artistic director and a professional technical manager, and so they would support the students in terms of making work and what have you, and so in terms of it being kind of a vocational training that one embarked upon entirely extracurricularly, it was a really invaluable thing, and so that was part of my university life from within about 6 months of landing there.
Right.
So as much as I'm sort of studying English and philosophy, I'm also, by the time I get to the start of second year, I formed a band from this kind of open mic thread.
Yeah.
And I'm also, directing plays and lighting plays. And so the three things are all kind of happening simultaneously. And by the time I get to the end of university, I've managed to come away with a degree, but also this band called Elephant
we've recorded an album, we've toured around Ireland, and the Students' Drama Society has made a number of weird and strange shows that have gone to the Irish Student Drama Awards and won awards and various things like that. So so it kind of all happens together. And by the time I get to the sort of the end of the formal education part, what I know on some level is that I need to prolong the education part. And I suppose if I'm entirely honest, what I'm thinking in this moment is that maybe there's a way to be an academic by day and a musician by night.
Oh, you had that thought?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was the sort of the loop. Insofar as there was a plan at all,
yeah,
that was the plan. And in the course of studying philosophy and English as a kind of joint degree, there had been a lot of modules that veered into film. So various kinds of film studies, European film, philosophy of film. And I had taken all of those modules and those had been the ones that I'd enjoyed the most. So if I was going to make a go of doing the academic thing, then, you know, the film part was the part that I found the most kind of enjoyable and interesting. So I approached the film lecturer who I kind of had the most respect for in Cork, an Italian woman, Laura Roscaroli. And she kind of just sort of blankly said, if you're serious about studying film, you need to leave Ireland.
Okay.
Because the courses aren't here, that, you know, it's sort of not here. She mentioned four locations in the UK, Glasgow being one of them, as having a good department or, you know, a strong department. So, and Brian, I don't even entirely know why, but I only applied to Glasgow. It was the only one that sort of...
Some strange draw.
Well, then there's various funny coincidence things whereby I applied to study a master's in screen studies at the Department of Theatre, Film and Television. with TFTS at Glasgow Uni. I can't remember.
Film, television studies.
Yeah, exactly. Presumably. Or maybe it's television, film and theatre studies. I don't know.
We'll never know, perhaps.
We'll never know. TFTS at Glasgow Uni. Mm. And then about a week after making that application, this show called Bright Colours Only tours to the theatre, this Granary Theatre in Cork, where I've now kind of ended up on the payroll as a sort of summer job as a techie and box office. And... Pauline Goldsmith and her then sort of touring manager Davey Archibald, and Berkey. I presume Berkey is still knocking around.
I don't know who that is.
Berkey is definitely a Glasgow theatre human. I've encountered him only a handful of times since.
Sometimes I wish that I could dig into the other episodes and have everyone here from all the other episodes. Yeah, because there's going to be 17 people that would know what you were
exactly
talking about. People probably screaming into their headphones right now.
Yeah, yeah. And the three of them show up with this hearse.
Oh, right.
I'm pretty sure they've got a hearse, don't they? Yeah, they do. I think they've got a hearse. They're touring a hearse.
Oh, it's the funeral show.
It's the funeral show.
Yes. Yeah, I know, of course.
And its first iteration.
Right.
The 2004 iteration.
So this theatre was a receiving house as well. So stuff came there.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So Bright Colours Only tours to this theatre. And it transpires that Davey Archibald is finishing his PhD in the very department that I'm about to start my master's. Or have applied. I mean, I haven't been accepted at this point. Uh-huh, yeah. But I've applied to do it. And amongst other things, they gave me a bottle of Famous Grouse for helping them out. And I'm like, geez, these Glaswegian people are brilliant.
I have to go there.
And I remember Davey's mom came over to see the show in Cork, and as part one of my duties was I had to carry the coffin, one of the people carrying the coffin, out to the hearse at the end of the show.
Was it weighed down?
I don't recall it being like full coffin heavy. I don't think it was. Mm-hmm. But what I do recall is that Davey's mum came over to me, you know, he introduced me to his mum after, and she's like, oh, nice to meet you, son, nice to meet you. Just so you know, your flies were down.
Oh, for goodness sake.
So yeah, it was the pallbearer with the flying low. So
that's the title of another show for you. See, they just come thinking fast.
So that was my introduction to sort of theatre and Glasgow.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And in all fairness to him, this does make sense. I met, this all connects up, I guess. Davey met me, you know, for a couple of cups of coffee after I moved over and introduced me to people who ended up being very important and influential. But also we had this one conversation where I was trying to figure out, having done the master's,
whether or not doing a PhD was a sensible thing to do.
In further film stuff?
Further film stuff. And again, in that year, I don't think I... Yeah, in that sort of year, I'd started to, again, do the open mic nights at Nice and Sleazy's and, and you know, sort of made friends in the... more music friends than theatre friends at this point. And Davey kind of said, well, what do you really want to do? And I said, to be honest, Davey, I want to do music. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, a PhD could be something that you kind of pursue whilst you're trying to make that happen. But the other thing he said was, you can do music if you're prepared to do it in a lot of different ways. So
very good, yeah.
You know, maybe one day you're writing about it, because I was doing reviews for things at the time, and maybe the next day you're teaching about it, or you're doing a participatory arts or community arts, and maybe the next day you're playing a gig with your band. And I just it that had never been described to me before.
That's this idea, brilliant advice.
Yeah, this idea that of, oh, I guess it's called the portfolio career. I don't know if it still is or if it was ever.
It certainly was about then. Yeah.
Yeah. I had never conceived of it. And I think that's the thing that Glasgow, in so many ways, brought to my world was people either telling or modelling sort of ways of making a living doing things that they love doing, which was not something I had experienced to anything like the same extent where I came from. You know, your job was your job of work. Yeah. And it was not something to be fulfilled by or to enjoy. It was the thing that you did to pay the bills.
Yeah. And anything else in your spare time, well, good luck to you.
Good luck. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So how much has, in the years since, how much has that portfolio career changed or found direction? Or
I mean, I guess the sort of... The bit of the portfolio marked theatre has probably expanded fairly significantly over the years to the point where at the moment it's certainly kind of the lion's share of what I do. And within the theatre parts, sometimes it's composition, sometimes it's sound design, sometimes it's musical direction. Often it's some composite of the three things.
Yeah.
And that's probably been the most significant sort of shift, is that it's in that there was a period of time where about 6 years where I was sort of very actively being in a band as well as doing the theatre stuff. Although truthfully, the band, as much as was called Zoe Van Gogh, and we did lots of really great things. We, you know, we got to make albums and go on tours and all that kind of stuff. And we were in, you know, very, very fortunate in that we always managed to sort of cover our costs and what have you. But we never, ever, ever the once paid ourselves a wage from being in the band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that in some ways that was the thing that theatre presented at a kind of early point, was this idea that this thing that I do is valued within it to the point that someone will pay me, you know, potentially, if I gather it all together, enough to get by, which was something that just seemed to be more viable or more possible within the context of theatre than it was just sort of in the kind of purely band bit, or certainly the indie band bit.
Yeah, especially to realise that you were with the band moderately successful.
Yeah.
And even at that,
yeah,
you still don't actually make anything from it.
Nothing at all.
Yeah, it's pretty sad.
Yeah, it's sort of mad.
Yeah.
And that sort of, like, I mean, it's hard not to sort of tell some of those stories and feel like you're, you know, your man from The League of Gentlemen, Les McQueen.
Yes.
It's a shit business. Like, it's hard not to feel like you're becoming Les McQueen.
Yeah, yeah.
But experiences like we did this really gorgeous tour with Belle and Sebastian where we were playing to these, you know, they were playing to 3,000 seater venues in Europe. I mean, we played to this 3,000 seater venue in Paris, and it was good, and we were good. And Matt Brennan, who was a drummer, you know, a tremendous sort of raconteur and storyteller, as well as playing really good drums and writing songs. And his special sort of his secret weapon in this instance was that he has pretty fluent French, but Canadian French, because he grew up and was taught French in Canada. And it turns out Parisians, you know, go crazy for the cute Canadian French accent. So he had them in the palm of his hand from the moment he opened his mouth. And so we got to the end of our support set with Belle and Sebastian in Paris, and we had actual Parisians shouting encore.
Wow.
It can't get any better than this.
And you didn't make any money.
We have landed. We made some money from that. But the thing is, 2 months later, we're doing the UK tour, our own UK tour, to try to promote our second album. And we end up, it's kind of going okay. The venues are small, the fees aren't great, but there's been various sort of miscommunications, and we're driving into London to play a night. I think the night was called Club Fandango. And people are saying things like, oh yeah, man, Club Fandango, that's a great gig. How'd you get that gig? It's a great gig. Yeah. And then eventually the email somehow kind of gets dredged up, where we discover that unless we have 20 people who show up on the door who say they're specifically there to see us, then we're not going to get our £50 fee for the privilege of playing Club Fandango that night. And at this point, we're touring four musicians and a sound engineer.
Oh, for goodness sake.
And it's like 50 quid. It's 50 quid. And you just realize you're just part of the indie music wallpaper. Like, you're utterly interchangeable. It could be... For anyone really cares, you could be any band in that moment, in that slot, in that bar. And so partly by contrast with having the kind of the experience, you know, with the Bells, and then also by contrast with the fact that there is this, and I can't remember what it would have been at the time, but, you know, there will have been either some theatre gig I had just done or some theatre gig upcoming where I was going to get paid like an actual fee, approaching a living wage.
Yeah, yeah.
And, It the band kind of called it quits maybe 9 months later, and it wasn't necessarily because of that experience in and of itself, but I think it was a combination of factors, and just the difference between starting a band in your kind of early mid 20s and the realities of that in your sort of early 30s, late 20s, early 30s.
It's a different story.
Different things.
It's a wee bit like that thing that we hear all the time as actors or someone, you know, if you say, do you know what? I'm not going to do that thing because it's demeaning or it's badly paid or something. And someone will say, well, you know, if you don't, someone else will.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you think, gee, someone will.
Yeah.
And until no one does, that's always going to be somehow acceptable.
Can I tell you my most glamorous Zoe Van Gogh story?
Please
do. My absolute favourite. We were invited to play it wasn't a students' union, but it was like the Student Music Society, I think, organised gigs in Nottingham. And University of Nottingham. And so we played this gig just before Christmas. It'll either be 2010 or 2011. And it's, you know, it's just before Christmas. Technically, all the students have already kind of gone home. But we go down to do the show, and the convener of the student society or whatever says that he can put us up in his flat because all his flatmates have gone home. So we end up going back to his flat after the gig. And myself and Matt, as I recall, end up sleeping on a constantly deflating blow-up mattress on the kitchen floor.
Oh, for goodness sake.
But this is the best part, right? So then at some point, you know, you go to the bathroom to use the facilities. And because it's the week before Christmas and no one's in the flat, like, there's no toilet roll. The toilet roll's gone.
Okay, forget that.
But what there is there is a stack of flyers for the show that we've just played. So we literally spend that night wiping our feces with our faces. So,
and there's a song title as well. So that's good. Oh,
like the
man.
glamour.
And you just go, what is this?
Why?
And everyone wants to be in a band when they're a kid as well. Like the bands that we started at school. And the band name was that. I mean, we still have that conversation now, and it's about what we're going to call the show.
Yeah.
It's the worst question.
I hate it.
We named the podcast name. It goes on for hours and hours. At one point, yeah. I can't remember if I've told this story in the show, but I was in a band with Gary McNair when we were 18.
Oh, I don't think I know this. Tell me more.
And we eventually were called Rochi, which was actually the nickname of his mate.
Oh, yeah. I've met Rochi.
You met Rochi, right?
Yeah.
And we used to say it at our gigs. It was the most ridiculous thing, but we used to say it at the gigs. We are Rochi. Now over there is Rochi the human. We are Rochi the band. I mean, just, I don't know what possessed us, but we were in my loft for the first ever rehearsal.
Uh-huh.
And one of the boys who was in the band, who I'd just met that day, I'd handed out all my used week bus tickets because I kept them all in my pocket, so that the boys could use them. Because very seldom the driver would actually check the date. So at the time I would keep them all. And they were a paper bus ticket in those days that you would put on a big cardboard strip and then put sticky back plastic over the top of it.
Yeah, you know? I know exactly the
thing.
You
know the one?
Yeah.
And I had them folded in half and I handed them out to the boys. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Got the bus home and they all come up to the loft and we started playing and messing about. And then we started the conversation about what is the band going to be called.
And
of course, at that time, we didn't know what we were getting ourselves into. That it was going to be days and weeks and hours of this carrying
agonizing,
on.
Yeah.
And eventually I was getting so sick of it, I said, look, I'm going downstairs. Who wants teas and coffees? And Doogie went, cheese and coffee. That's what I've got. I was like, I didn't even say that. Also, that's a terrible name. Even if I did say it, it's a terrible name. But you get to a point where you don't even know what's good anymore.
No, you don't.
Cheese and coffee, brilliant. No, it's not.
No, no.
We all need to get some sleep.
I mean, I'm not saying Zoe Van Gogh was brilliant, but there was a period of time where we were called the Lost Marbles.
Oh, that's Christ. Awful. That's awful.
Jesus.
You hear those band names. I mean, they're everywhere, of course. They can't all be good.
I mean, one of my very favourite bands, full stop, is a band called Lamb Chop.
Hmm.
Oh, it's a dreadful name. Come on, Lamb Chop.
Yeah.
It's an awful name.
Well,
for a
also, that was a puppet in
well, yes,
American
also,
television.
Indeed. Yeah.
So many reasons that's wrong.
Too many. Yeah.
Oh, man. So, is there a band now?
No, there hasn't since Zoe Van Gogh. I've been very lucky to get to play with some really lovely musicians. So, every so often, Aidan Moffat will pull me in to finger the accordion. And
that fucking thing.
and that's just always a total joy and a privilege.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I love his stuff anyway, but also it's the thing that if I could have more of, the one thing I would want more of in terms of what I do professionally is just to be able to actually play a musical instrument with another human being.
Yeah,
in the
yeah.
room. And yeah. just and
so, there's less of that than people might think.
There's way less.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's yeah. 90% of it is me with my computer. You know, well, maybe not 90%, but certainly a huge amount of it
yeah,
is
totally.
me and the laptop. So just that kind of playing with other people.
We were in a band together once.
Yeah, we were.
For a night, do you remember?
For a night, yeah.
Yeah, with who else? A fella called Adam, who was
an
amazing bassist.
Tremendous. Yeah, Adam is absolutely. So Adam is a very good friend, an incredible musician, and also one of those guys, Adam Scott, who has the patience and the care to look over my, you know, horrifying attempts at sheet music
right.
when I do make them. So
he has patience and care in abundance, though. He was just a yeah. presence. It was like, who's yeah. this guy? He was like, hey.
Wonderful
yeah.
guy. So Adam
Shoes
Scott.
Off, long hair.
Yeah, yeah.
Chill.
So he joins Zoe Van Gogh for the last sort of two and a half years in the band. And I sometimes feel sorry for Adam because he came in and, you know, in some ways, you know, things we got to do some of the most exciting things. But on the other hand, the shine had sort of worn off a little bit as well. You know,
right.
the second 3 years, not quite so kind of happy and joyful
no,
as the first three
of
years.
Of course not. Who else was in that band of ours?
So
Francis Thorburn, of course, and Cora Bissett were the
yes,
vocalists.
Yes, were the vocalists. And
Who played drums? Oh, what's the fella's name? He's
James.
An amazing drummer. James.
James Grant.
Grand
tremendous drummer.
Yeah, he was brilliant.
Yeah.
What a fun we had.
Yeah, it was loads of fun.
Yeah, playing. I remember saying, see in the middle of this, whatever it was, I think it was Jolene.
Yes.
But real-time version of Jolene.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I said, I'll put a reel in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And then we started, and I said, that's fine. And we ran through it. And then when we started doing it with Francis singing,
yeah.
I suddenly realized it was like 130 beats a minute. And
yeah,
I was like,
yeah.
Okay.
yeah.
And it's funny how when you're thrown in at the deep end, yeah. you just go.
Oh, that was.
Was it Jolene?
No, it was Can't Get You Out of My Head.
That's right, because Jolene was Jig.
Yeah. Very cool. Great moment.
Great fun.
Yeah.
Fun night.
So let's do that again.
Let's do that again sometime. That's how we first met.
Yeah.
Despite me having seen your work and loved
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah,
one of the things I saw that I loved was Pause with a Smile.
Oh, Pause with a
I
Smile.
I loved the music and I loved that show.
That gang of people as well, though, like Gareth Nichols, Kieran Hurley, Gary, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah, just great people.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember watching it from the tech box in Trav 2 because of not having a ticket or whatever just being enchanted by it.
One of the madnesses about that show was that, as I recall, we did it all on tape.
Ah.
I think.
Were the tape players in the space?
The tape players, but it was actual tapes in the actual tape players.
Brilliant.
So it wasn't sort of faked, you know, queued on QLab. It was, I'm pretty sure now.
That rings a bell, yeah.
I think, so basically the guys queued all their own sound.
That's so cool.
From the stage, but by actually playing it off of tapes.
It's not done often now.
C90s, C60s or whatever.
When we were at the Academy now, we used those little tape players. You know the mm-hmm. ones where the handle comes out?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Little oblong. Yeah. We used them all the time.
Andy Cannon, who I've made a couple of shows with, sort of, the first time I worked with him, I was playing some sound effects back and he's like, the marvel of digital sound. And I didn't really understand what he found so marvellous about it. But what he said was, back in the day, you could tell when a sound effect was about to happen because you'd hear the hiss of the tape starting up.
Oh, man.
And then, you know, cue
wind.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Or it's a thunderstorm or whatever.
When someone opens the door, and then it's off when they close it. Don't you love that? Like in an Agatha Christie play or something.
It's tape noise, so yeah.
Wow. Well, listen, great to talk to you.
Oh, cool.
I don't know how to end them any better than I know how to start them. So just
that's great.
Say something weird and laugh. Or I'll put a sound effect on it.
Yeah.
I'll put the wind on it and then shut the door and you're gone. Never done that before, but I've seen so many. I saw a great play, I probably told you about it, with Jimmy Cricket. It was Jimmy Cricket's own writing as well, and there was a bit where, or in lots of times actually, not just a bit, but every time they opened the door to the dressing room where most of the play was set, there would be this howling wind, and they kept saying, oh, there's this terrible storm outside, but I couldn't figure out, does the dressing room have a door to the outside? And they have to come... The stage manager had to go outside to come back in. Otherwise, why on earth would the storm be in the corridor? I don't know. Maybe it was more avant-garde than I realised. Anyway, there he goes with the wind taking him through up the road. The wind going through his sails. I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore. That was great to talk to MJ McCarthy. What a pleasure. And as we talked about, we were in a band for one gig only. So hopefully more of that at some point. Now remember that you can go onto the website, puttingittogethercast.com, look out for the yellow donate button and you can make a small donation. Or do you know what else? You can make a big donation, whatever you want, to grow this show and get it to be heard by as many people as possible. And there's other ways to do that. Add it to your Instagram story, tweet about it, talk about it on Facebook and make sure to tag us. So there you go. All those ways are all available to you. And until next week, I guess, when there will be a new episode with another guest and it goes on and on and on. I don't want to say it goes on and on. That makes it sound like it's a drag. No. But next week there will be another episode and I'll be delighted to bring it to you because I always am. As I say, I'm sitting in my wee happy place. Tuesday night, I get to sit and I get to talk to you and tell you what's happening. So that's what's happening. And also remember that the Or and More this week in Glasgow, top of Byers Road, of course, is Dusty Won't Play by Annie Caulfield and starring Francis Thorburn, Andy Clark and Kevin Lennon, directed by Marilyn Imrie, and it's on until this Saturday. Get down there if you get a chance. What a fantastic show. So till next week, cheerio now.